Conference number 22, 9 a.m., September 28, 1985. Father Hugo.
Time is getting short. I hope now you'll be faithful to the end, to your silence and prayer. You make the retreat yield every possible grace. I know you're impatient to go. All those attachments are pulling at you, but we hope that you'll resist them now till tomorrow. We're losing a couple, I'm sorry, but I know we usually lose a couple of priests at the last time. We never get to teach them how to die. And meanwhile, it's time, I think, finally for a commercial. This is probably the longest period in the last 20 years that you've lived without a commercial. And so it's time for me to make my commercial. And I'm putting out some schedules there for retreats. We hope that you'll perhaps come back again and bring others back to retreat. If you think that your experience has been worthwhile, tell them about it and send them back. I know that everybody wouldn't be interested in, but you might know some people that you think would be interested. So there's some schedules there. There's two schedules. We have only one more retreat for 1985. Now, that's a light yellow schedule, if you want to take any of them, or if you just want the one is on November the 10th, I think, is the date of the last retreat this year. Yeah, November 10th and November the 17th. That's before Thanksgiving. So there's some of those leaflets back there, too. But then the next year we have one for next year. It's buff colored, a little bit darker than the other. And there are five retreats listed for next year. Our retreats depend on the schedule of the sisters. We fit them in as best we can in their schedule. This is their mother house, and they have a busy schedule of activities all year long. And so it's a little hard sometimes to sneak in a few of these retreats. And like tomorrow, we'll hardly be out of here and they'll be in. So don't get excited if you're rushed a bit. We hope you'll take some of these and plant them where they'll bear some fruit and keep one for yourself. Maybe you'll come back again. Next year, I will celebrate my 50th anniversary as a priest. I invite you all to come back and celebrate with me by making a retreat with me. I don't know how long I'll be able to continue with these retreats, so we'll welcome you back then if you come and take some to others. We find that advertisements in papers, it does a little bit of good in the diocesan paper, but not much. And especially in distant papers, the people tend to gravitate to their own, and we haven't had much response. Furthermore, we don't have much of a budget for advertising, and so we can't do that. And I really don't believe much in it. I think it should go by word of mouth. And that if you think it's a worthwhile thing, well, you'll tell others. We usually have enough. We've never really been without a quorum of retreatants. And sometimes people wait too long. Like this time, we've had to turn some away because they wait too long to register. And so you might keep that in mind. We have only 25 rooms that we can dispose of. So now also I'm going to give you each a book of my conferences. I thought I had one here to show you, but I don't see it here. Something happened to it. Do you have one, Ed? These, I gave you an outline, but these are the conferences written out. Sort of a dirty trick, perhaps. I give it to you only at the end, but I wanted you to work. Yeah, I know whenever you give a student a textbook, why they get lazy. It's all in there. I'll wait till the examination. And so they miss classes and all that bit. This depends on personal work, personal response, and so I didn't want to tempt you that way. But I give it to you to recall the conferences and maybe to write your own notes in them. I think those notes you write are important to you. Your observations and your thoughts, your responses, your reactions, they're important to you. They're a record of your thinking. Even though you were copying my words sometime, you were thinking yourself and interpreting as you went along. So that's important. And then you can transfer them to the margins. Don't be afraid to mark a book up. It's your book. Destroy it by your notes. Make it your own. And it's my gift to you. If you want to make an offering, okay. Now, some of the books that I'm giving to you are imperfect copies. Slightly imperfect. We had a bad run. And so they're slightly imperfect. You may not even be able to find the imperfection. I hope you can't. But it may show up in time. But if you want any other books, we're going to ask you I don't put a price on them, but for an offering. I'm not in the commercial business of selling books, but we do have to pay for these things. And if you want to help, the offering for one of these books is $6. But the first one is free. And for you, and then the other books would put a price on them. Now, people have asked me in the course of time to get them spiritual reading, about spiritual reading. We don't have a bookstore here, again, I don't want to get into the commerce of it. We have, at this urging, I've provided about, I guess, a half a dozen books that I think are basic for spiritual reading, and I have to charge you for them. I get no, dealer's discount or anything like that. And so we charge you at what we pay them for. I think one of them is below cost because it was sold to us below cost. But one of them is, which I think should be on the shelves of everyone living a spiritual life, is the Introduction to Devout Life by St. Francis Sales, a new edition, a new translation of it. Another one is The Imitation of Christ. Another one is Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Of all the spiritual, you've asked me about contemporary spiritual, I think he's the soundest and the best. He's an Anglo-Catholic, not a Roman Catholic. But I've never found a word or a phrase that I had to change or disagree with. He's thoroughly Catholic. More Catholic than many Catholic priests that are writing today. And so I can recommend it to you without hesitation. Mere Christianity means basic Christianity, and that's what this is. My first book of conferences I call just Applied Christianity. We're not trying to teach any new religion or any liberal views or any advanced views. It's simply basic Christianity. And that's what C.S. Lewis does, and he does it beautifully. He's a magnificent teacher. And I recommend any of his books to you. Especially, I recommend Beyond Personality. This Mere Christianity is a collection of three of his small books. And one is Beyond Personality. I think that's a classic. And it's the last one, but they're all worthwhile. So there's three books there. And then another book of his I recommend is The Great Divorce. It's not about marriage at all. It's about the distance between heaven and hell. And then the Screwtape Letters. Wise and witty counsels, I quoted some of them for you, about the spiritual life. From the point of view of the devil, the underside. And they're very excellent. So I would recommend that to you. And there are couple other books that I have in the list. I'll mention them later, that you can take if you want. I'm not trying to sell you any books. I don't like to bring people here. I know you're a captive audience and sell your books. But some people don't have easy access to stores, and sometimes these books are hard to get. They're available, but they're not easy to get unless you have a bookstore that's willing to do it for you. So we'll put them out this evening. I don't want to turn a retreat into a flea market. I want you to keep your silence till the end, so we'll put these out here on a table after the last conference this afternoon, and then you can come up after dinner and look them over if you wish and take what you want, and take your one free copy of this, Your Ways Are Not My Ways. And then there's another one that I wrote, which is The Story of the Retreats. These retreats have a history, the model of this retreat, and so I'd like to share it with you, and so you can take one of those books. We ask an offering for it. I think it's $2. And you really can't buy a book these days for $6 or $2, so we're really giving you a bargain anyhow. And we rely on the generosity of some of our friends to help us to defray the expenses. Well, I guess that's all. That's my commercial. That's the only one. Now we'll go on with our subject, but we'll begin with a prayer. Our theme is the will of God, and so we will introduce it with the prayer, which expresses that desire to do the will of God. Here I am, Lord, I come to do your will.
Here I am, Lord, I come to do your will.
I have waited for the Lord, and he stooped towards me and heard my cry. And he put a new song into my mouth, a hymn to our God. Here I am, Lord, I come to do your will. Sacrifice or oblation you wish not, but ears open to obedience you gave me. Holocaust or sin offerings you sought not. Then I said, behold, I come.
Here I am, Lord, I come to do your will.
In the written scroll it is prescribed for me to do your will, O my God, and it is my delight, and your law is within my heart. Here I am, Lord. I announced your justice in the great assembly of the people. I will not restrain my lips, as you know well, God. Here I am, Lord, I come to do your will. Now we come back to the will of God. We've seen that the will of God is our constant rule. And now that we've been purified by bringing, I assume that we have in our minds at any rate, bringing the samples under control so that we can walk amid the beauties of this world with our eyes fixed on God, glorifying God for their goodness and their good beauty, but remaining unselflessly unattached to them. Able to use them not for our own glory, but his glory. Moving among them with detachment and using them always to glorify him. We assume that we have done this. We've passed through that. Now we desire to live up in the higher regions of the atmosphere and of the spiritual life and to live in constant union with God. Remember, love begins in preference, so we prefer God to the samples. And it ends in union. And so we're seeking to be united with God. This is the way that that lay people can live what we called earlier a mixed life. And I'm going to jump from St. John of the Cross here to St. Francis de Sales, who made it his mission to introduce the contemplative life to people in the world. And his great classic, A Treatise on the Love of God, will be my textbook, my background for what I have to say this morning and this afternoon. A Treatise on the Love of God, one of the perennial classics of the Christian life. So we jump from peak to peak, from John of the Cross to St. Francis de Sales, both of them doctors of the church, both of them absolutely orthodox and safe guides, and both of them saints, so that we can rely on them completely. So, starting last night, the conferences are based on this treatise on the love of God by St. Francis de Sales. He was the first Catholic who wanted to form an active religious community for women. There had never been, all religious communities for women had been contemplative communities. St. Ignatius Loyola was the first one to organize a religious community, an active religious community for men, the Jesuit congregation. And now Francis de Sales desired to do it for women, but he was frustrated. Even saints and bishops sometimes are frustrated. He was not able to do it. He founded a congregation which he then dedicated to the mixed wife with the help of St. Jane Frances de Chantal, who was his partner in these works. And they are called the Visitation Sisters. Some of you know them. We had one here at the last retreat. There's a convent of them nearby in Wheeling. And that was their purpose. The first one to organize an active community for religious, women religious, was St. Vincent de Paul with his co-worker, St. Louise de Marillac, the Sisters of Charity, who quickly became well-known and greatly beloved because of their works of mercy, especially on the battlefield. And they became the Angels of Mercy of Europe, as they were called. And so that encouraged the growth of the sisters of active communities of sisters. And now they say there's so many communities of sisters, that's one of the three things that even God doesn't know, how many there are. And so it's spawned out. But St. Francis de Sales, meanwhile, had written this great treatise for the guidance of his group and for anyone that would read it, tying together the active and the contemplative life in a mixed life and teaching people how to live a life of union with God anywhere. You don't, without going into a Carmelite or a Carthusian convent or a monastery. And so we will be considering these truths this morning and this afternoon. Remember, the purpose is to unite our wills to God. We're like a child waiting for his daddy to come home from work, or maybe nowadays for his mother to come home from work, and with his nose pushed up against the window pane, waiting for the bus, waiting for the trolley, waiting for the car to come. And as soon as he sees the bus come up the street, he runs out, or she runs out, and meets the bus, and the father steps out and gathers his child up into his arms. This is the end of the day. Well, now that's what a good symbol of what we're going to do now. We wish to watch and learn where our Father's will is. And whenever we see it, we will embrace it. And so our purpose is to discuss it, because we wish not just to obey God's will on Sunday morning or on Vespers on Thursday evening or at odd times, but continuously, as far as that is humanly possible with the limitations of our minds. With the imbecility of our minds, as the Latins used to say, that there's a certain weakness of our minds, and so we can't have this constant concentration. We're too distracted. But as far as it's humanly possible, we would like to live in union with God. And St. Francis Sales guy gives us methods where he guides us to do this. He distinguishes the will of God into different aspects for our convenience. Now, there's only one will of God, and there's not a half a dozen, but we can look at it from different points of view, as you can say, look at a palace from different points of view, or a building. And so we can look at God from different points of view, and in this way he speaks of different wills of God. And I'm only going to take two of them. They're the decisively important ones for practical usage, but he has several aspects of God's will if you ever read the book. And the two that I'm going to take are called the express will of God and the will of God's good pleasure. The express will of God and the will of God's good pleasure. And with those two concepts, we are able to trace God's will throughout our activities. We can find God in silence and solitude in our prayer bench or our prayer corner or in church, but here our purpose is to find God's will everywhere so that we can walk in his presence, as the scriptures put it, and always be united to him. And this way we bring the life of prayer. Sometimes people say they pray in their work, but I think sometimes these people are very distracted by their work from God. And we want to do our work faithfully. This is not an exemption from work. Living in union with God should drive us, impel us to do our work more faithfully and more efficiently and more capably. We cannot offer second-rate goods to God. He wants the first fruits. He wants the best. And we must be sure that we offer him the best that we can do, the best that is in us. And so that we're not going to offer him here a second-rate kind of sacrifice, but we're going to live in union with him in truth, but without stepping away from our obligations, our active and obligations that are placed upon us, the work that we've assumed, the vocations, the professions that we've taken upon ourselves to carry out. We will work within them, but work always all to can be in continual the presence of God. Now, this morning we'll consider the express will of God, and this afternoon we will take up the question of the will of God's good pleasure. That's the most difficult, and it is also the peak of the whole Christian life. Not only of this retreat, but of the whole Christian life. But the express will is a necessary preparation. Now, by the express will of God, we mean just what it says. God does indicate his will to us in many ways, and we have to find those ways. He expresses his will. He tells us. He spells it out. That's what the express will of God means. And therefore, we have a guide in this. How we can find the express will of God. Where does he spell it out? And our union is with God's will. And wherever it's expressed, we want to find it. One of the Psalms, Psalm 119, has 169 or 170 verses, and every one of them has some word that is a synonym for the express will of God. It shows the devotion of the saints of the Old Testament to seeking the will of God. So it's an old tradition to do this. The will of God, the laws of God, the manifestation of God, you read it to see. He finds, 169 synonyms for the will of God and celebrates the will of God. Some people think, of course, that was faulty, that's Phariseeism, that's legalism. It could be either. It could be a Pharisee that celebrates the external will of God, but it could be a spiritual person, a saint, that is looking for every indication of God's will. And that's what we wish to do, to look for any indication of God's will and then unite ourselves, embrace it in love. This is the way we can live in constant union with God. Now, how does God express his will? First of all, he expresses it in sacred scripture, and in the sacred scripture in his commandments, the Old Testament and the New Testament, especially the New Testament, but the Old Testament too is a prophetic and indication of God's will. We can't take the Old Testament as final. Sometimes Catholics even make that mistake. We can't take it as final. We always, when we read the Old Testament, we have to realize it's incomplete. The crown has not been given to it yet. The crown is Jesus Christ with his teaching. And so there are some indications of God's will in the Old Testament that are imperfect. Some are mixed up with things which are barbarian or pagan. For example, many people have trouble with those words in the Old Testament, those wars that the Old Testament prophets fought, like Samuel, exterminating a whole people. It's hard to think that's the will of God. And so some Catholics have dissented from that, like Simone Weil. She was of Jewish background, but she refused to accept some of these, like when Samuel told Saul to exterminate the Amalekites. Man, woman, child, their livestock and everything, simply wipe them out. Little hard to think that's the will of God. God loves people. He comes not to condemn, but to save. But the Jews had an imperfect vision, and that seems to show there. I'm just giving you that as an example. Or whenever Elijah sicked the bears on the boys that had ridiculed him because he was bald-headed. And he punished them by sending bears to destroy them. Pretty hard to think of a prophet of God doing anything like that, but it's in the scriptures. So things like that, you see, they trouble many people, and that they could be thought it was the will of God. But people took them as the will of God, and they didn't discriminate. I think we have to discriminate now, especially here in the Old Testament, that there were some barbarisms that crept in there. Well, but the Old Testament still is the manifestation, prophetically, of God's wisdom. And there we find a double strain. We find this extreme nationalism among some of the Jews, and even among some of the prophets. But like in Isaiah, he was certainly an ecumenist centuries before Christ. He longed and looked forward to the union of all people under Yahweh. And that's why he's so often quoted and cited in our liturgy. He's the great prophet of Christ, the universalism of Jesus Christ. There was nothing nationalistic or restricted in him. He was thoroughly Catholic, universal. Well, but there's also this strain of narrow parochial prophecy in the Old Testament that kept God's providence confined to the Jewish people. And we need to be aware of it, too. It only was gradually that the sights of the Jews widened out, and some of them have never widened out to include all peoples within the providence of God. They still claim, I believe, this exclusivism. Well, now, the express will of God, or the commandments of the Scriptures. There are not so many commandments as you might think in all those books of Scriptures. There's only the Ten Commandments, and then in the New Testament, there's really no commandments except the great commandment of love. It's only mentioned once in each of the three synoptic Gospels at a climactic point close to the Passion of Jesus. The Ten Commandments are never put down, what might say, promulgated in the New Testament. They appear only once. That's in the story of the rich young man. They're mentioned incidentally by Jesus. But he never mentions them with any great force. He never tries to inculcate them or enforce them. He takes them for granted. They were already known to be God's will. He does not abolish them. As I think I said, he fulfills them by showing that the love of neighbor is also the love of enemy. And he completes the circle of love, therefore. It includes everyone. The Jews had not appreciated that. They considered love your neighbor. They interpreted neighbor as your fellow countryman. They had a narrow nationalistic view for the most part, except a few like Isaiah. And now Jesus corrects that. Love also your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Now love everyone. And it is the basic, final, great law of God. And the Ten Commandments remain as a starting point, as a floor that shows us, and they're important, the Ten Commandments are important because they show us the basic, irreducible minimum that we can practice and still claim to love God. That's why those who try to abolish or set aside these Ten Commandments because they say we're beyond that, it's a new ball game now, it's a New Testament now. No, it's not in that respect. I came to fulfill the law, not to destroy it, said Jesus. You'll find that too in his Sermon on the Mount. And so and St. Paul said that too, as I point out, that love is the fulfillment of the law. All these essential precepts of God are now fulfilled. We know their meaning, their purpose, from the love of God. That connection was vague with the Jews. Now Christ has made it unmistakably clear. There's only one love, the love of God, which is also the love of neighbor. Not two loves. We might call the love of neighbor second, but we don't mean it's secondary, because it's the only way we can practice the first law of love, which is the love of God. Now, St. John does not even mention the great commandment of the law at all. And yet he's called the apostle of love. He's always talking about love of neighbor. You have to realize that they identify the love of God with the love of neighbor. The story of the Good Samaritan, that identifies the love of God with the love of neighbor. Jesus, as we'll see in the text that we will bring up and which we know, he says, he who is mercy to the least of my brethren does it also to me. He identifies himself with the neighbor. So, the love of God and the love of neighbor are the same. And a person who thinks they can put themselves in the corner and turn their eyes up to God and turn their back to their neighbor or ignore their neighbor, and he who says he loves his neighbor and he hates his loves God and hates his neighbor, he is a liar, says St. John in his first letter. And also, if you love your God, how can you close up the bowels of your mercy against your neighbor, he says. We cannot do that. So the love of God and the love of neighbor, they're the great all-pervasive law in the New, Old and New Testament. Now, then in addition to that, we have the counsels. Now, and as I said the other day, there are not just three counsels, there is a myriad of counsels in the Bible. Little hints and helps to find the will of God. That's the reason we read the Bible, the books of wisdom in the Old Testament, for example, the book of Job, there are hints. Remember, we always can know God's will only imperfectly. He's a spirit. And our methods of knowledge are through reason, so it's always going to be a search and a quest to seek God's will. And the counsels, sometimes we dismiss them contemptuously. We say it's only a counsel. Well, you see, a devout person, one who truly loves God or seeks to love God, will not use such language. St. Francis Sales says that he who despises the counsel commits a great sin. You'll find that in both his books, the introduction and in the treatise on the love of God. He who despises the counsel commits a sin. You don't despise, if you're in a great need in your work, in your profession, or in your family life, and you go to seek counsel, you don't despise that counsel. You really need it. You want it. Maybe the success of your marriage or your family or your job depends on the generous act of a friend to take time and give you counsel and help you. Sometimes the work of charity is nothing more than talking to somebody that needs to hear something. And so you don't say, oh, that's only a counsel, the heck with that business, you see. But we often say that about God. Oh, that's only a counsel, don't bother about that. Well, you wouldn't even bother reading the scriptures if you didn't bother about that. Because apart from the commandments which we've mentioned, there's no other commandments in the scriptures. But all these other works are simply counsels, ways to find God, ways to know, hints to how to find God's will. And it's always vague, and that's what this picture means if you have looked at it and noticed, that's what I put here, done by a Pittsburgh artist. You can't see anything there, but if you look at it, you'll see the figure of the crucifix there, and perhaps the figure of Mary standing beneath there, just vaguely. And it's a meditation on a text, and the text is this. Now we see in a dark manner, as in a mirror. So this is looking at God in a mirror, an old-fashioned mirror, before they had our silvered mirrors that make a mirror so bright and clear now. The ancient mirrors were dark, or semi-dark. And so this artist, he was a young Pittsburgh artist, and he painted that as a sort of a meditation. He gave it to me. And because we worked together on the liturgy, and so he gave that. And I value it because it says that even when God gives us his express will, we have to see God in a mystery. See? The greatness of the riches of the wonders of God. How wonderful his ways. How unsearchable how wonderful his wisdom. How unsearchable his ways. So we must always realize when we're seeking God's will, we're working in the clouds of mystery. We like to see things clear with our reason, but we can't. We have to be satisfied with these hints. And this is why, too, the counsels in the New Testament, the counsels in the Scriptures are important. Now, then God's law as expressed in Scriptures becomes clarified, too, in what we might call human ordinances and indications. And we can split these into two: those which come through the church and those which come through our nature. Through our nature and through human laws. So we can put two columns on our paper. The will of God in the center above, and then on one side, the will of God as shown in the churches of ordinances of the church, and on the other column, the will of God as shown in human ordinances. Now, let's take the human ordinances first, because we're born before we're reborn. So let's consider the human ordinances first. What are these ordinances or laws or indications? Well, first of all, and basically, is what is called the natural law. Or what, in a better phrase, C.S. Lewis calls the law of human nature. Some people misunderstand the phrase natural law, and then they get diverted. Because when we think of natural law, we think of a law like the law of gravity. And a law of gravity works of necessity. But we are human beings, and we don't work of necessity. And therefore, Lewis suggests that better if we use the word the law of human nature. Incidentally, you'll find, I think, the best treatise that I know of for general readers. In the seminary and studied this in philosophy, but I understand they don't study this anymore. Even seminarians don't study this anymore. And so I guess priests won't have a good understanding of it in the future. So, but one way in which you can study it in a very general way is in this book that I told you about, and which I will make available to you if you want, in Mere Christianity. As I said, it's really a collection of three little books. They're a collection of addresses which C.S. Lewis gave on the radio in England during the war, whenever England was desperate, and that was when he became famous at that time, during the Second World War. And he gave these little addresses, and they're beautifully clear and short. And so the first two of those books are concerned with the law of human nature. So that would be a good way for a layman to become acquainted with what we mean here by the law of human nature. Now, the law of human nature is something like this. God, we're always free. So no law takes away our freedom, except the biological laws that determine our bodily functions. They do take away our freedom. We have to serve them, preserve ourselves. And so, but there are laws that God, to guide our moral conduct, our social conduct, our intelligent conduct, they are patterns that are put in us, our human nature, and we've got to find them. For example, you know, we have to regulate our food. Now, God's not going to tell us what to eat. We've got to find out what is edible and what isn't. And if we decide that we like to eat ground glass, we won't have another meal ever. Our nature tells us this is not food. Our intelligence tells us. So, and then we find out that certain plants are poisonous or contain poison. They're not food. Sometimes it's hard to find them. We have an agency in the government that's still trying to find them. The Food and Drug Administration. And come up with new answers constantly. This is cancerous and so forth. So our intelligence has to discover them. Now, we can go ahead and eat or drink those things if we want. Our freedom is not suppressed. But nature will have its revenge if we break the laws of nature. We are learning this with such diseases as cancer and heart disease now, that nature will have its revenge. And we're told constantly that these are not caused by germs, but they're caused by our lifestyle. And more doctors are telling us these. And so we need to learn how to take care of our human nature. But we're free. I'm warned that cigarettes are dangerous to health and possibly lethal, but I can smoke them still. So whenever we speak about the law of human nature governing men, we don't mean it suppresses their freedom. It means it indicates certain patterns of behavior which are useful and healthful for us, but which we may break, but we will do so at the risk of our lives. Nature will have a terrible revenge. Now, some of these laws we know well. Our government is founded on them. They're in the political and social sphere. We know our government tells us in that all men are free in the Declaration of Independence. That's a law of nature. See, this is done by study. This is not revealed. It is revealed, but it's already revealed in nature. Our founding fathers were sometimes religious men, but most of them were not religious men. They were deists, for the most part, as I understand. A deist is one who believes in God, but does not believe that God's providence is active in the world. But at least they believed in God. And these laws, therefore, are laws, they said, they call them self-evident laws. That all men are free. All are free to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. These are all natural laws. This is what we mean by natural laws. God doesn't force us to be free, but He makes freedom available. Governments are suppressing it, as we've learned this week in our readings. But that's not the will of God, and therefore those governments, like Archbishop Romero Descartes said, they are not God's will. That was beautiful, you see, and that's truly Catholic what he said. Only those laws which are just can be called God's will. No unjust law can claim the authorship or the sanction of God. This is why Martin Luther King, even by Christians who falsely understood things, was called an anarchist whenever he disobeyed the civil laws of the United States. But the laws themselves were wrong and unjust in imposing slavery or keeping the results of slavery in. Discrimination. They are unjust laws. And Martin Luther King knew that. You see, he saw this. And that was why he advocated civil disobedience. Obedience to the civil law, but not to the law of God. He was obeying the law of God. And sometimes, as you can see, obedience is the easy thing to do. Catholics and Protestants, before Martin Luther King, found it easier to go along with the unjust laws that existed, especially in the South. I remember myself when I was a young man, I was put out of a restaurant in Washington that was reserved just for blacks. The blacks themselves put me out. That was against the law for a white to eat there, just as it was against the law for a black to eat in a white restaurant. These were unjust laws, but nobody saw it, and Catholics went along with it, and Protestants went along with it. Until Martin Luther King, or rather until that woman, refused to move to the back of the bus. That was what awakened even Martin Luther King to the real situation and started him on his career. This tired old lady in the front of the bus that said she would not go and take the seat that was reserved for the blacks. Well, so we had a new revolution in our country, a beneficial one for all of us. The whites learned a lot from this, too, as well as the blacks. But you see, an unjust law has no moral force. This is the reason for conscientious objections against war, too. Catholics think it's anarchy to make a conscientious objection to war. We have a tendency to think the government is always right. Our governments in these matters are mostly wrong. Only just laws have any moral force. Nuclear war is criminal, a crime against God and humanity, says the Second Vatican Council. And our preparations for it then are criminal. They're contrary to the law of God. So, well, we're back to the natural law. You see, they manifest God's will. And they're obviously, these are contrary to even to our American law, that all men are born free, all have the right to liberty and happiness.
Now then, that's insufficient, because men need things spelled out for them. So the next step is men themselves make laws, civil laws. And civil laws are articulate. They're an articulation. An articulation of what? They're an articulation of the natural law. Civil laws are intended to help us to do it. For example, thou shalt not kill. That's a natural law. And therefore, the government makes traffic laws. And whenever we drive an automobile, we have to realize that we're driving a machine which is a lethal danger. There's more people killed by automobiles every year than there were men killed in the Vietnam War. Yet we drive carelessly, we're contemptuous of traffic laws, we're publicly and officially contemptuous, like the big truckers. They carry their radios to avoid it. But if we love our neighbor as ourselves, then we will keep the traffic laws. This is the will of God for a Christian, because we are to preserve our life and to help preserve others' life. We should not dismiss them. We should not be looking in our rearview mirror to see if there's a cop behind us. You see, we can be united to God in that way, even if we are too off the...